Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the American Revolution all about, and what does it have to do with life in the 21st century? The basic facts, names, dates, battle outcomes, they're not much in dispute. And yet, for more than two centuries, we Americans have used the story of the nation's founding to demonstrate profoundly different notions of what the United States was, is, and can be. Andrew M. Schockett is Director of American Culture Studies and Associate Professor of History and American Culture Studies at Bowling Green State University. His new book is called Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. Andy, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You see the revolution as the most contested event in American history. What about it remains unsettled in our collective consciousness?
Well, I think you had it exactly right in your introduction that a lot of the basic facts and contours are hard to argue about. What we're still debating about, though, is what it means and what's most important and what to emphasize and how to understand the experiences then and why it's consequential to us today.
We should be clear here that your examination of this subject goes beyond the Revolutionary War itself, the start and end dates. Can you talk about the parameters that you set for yourself in studying this?
Sure, absolutely. It started basically what I'm looking at is the memory of the American Revolution. So seeing how over the past roughly 15 years or so, how we have remembered and portrayed the American Revolution roughly from the, say, 1763, the beginning of imperial tensions through the ratification of the Constitution in 1787.
So what kinds of issues do we draw on in the Revolution to debate in the modern era?
Well, there are a lot of different things. For example, when we think about what the American Revolution was it about national independence? Was it primarily about too high taxation? Was it primarily about personal freedom? So some of those issues, some of those more abstract issues. And then, of course, we debate it much more specifically in ways that actually have very specific consequences. And probably the best example of that is how often court cases, especially in the Supreme Court, in which are by definition constitutional cases, are often decided based upon justices and lawyers' interpretations of what the founders meant or what they intended to do when they drafted and when they ratified our federal Constitution.
Well, let's talk about that, because you identify two basic approaches that we tend to follow when we look at the Revolution: essentialist and then a term that you have coined called organicist. Explain those both for us, please.
Oh, absolutely. So essentialism is, first I should say that both of these entail an interpretation of the American Revolution, but also a particular way of understanding the past. Essentialism is the view that the American Revolution was a glorious one, mostly about protesting taxes and tyranny that reinforced conservative principles of national independence and personal liberty, and maybe even God's plan, and that history has one clear truth that we can know because it's evident in the documents. Organicists, on the other hand, believe that there are many pasts open to interpretation, and that often even over time we rethink what those pasts mean. And that the American Revolution, which was successful, was also an unfinished revolution, especially for African Americans.
So we can judge the values of the present compared with what we think the values of the past were and find them lacking or sufficient, or we can judge the actions of the past based on what our values are today.
And you know, we do that all the time. So you know, it can, and it happens on different levels just by deciding who among that revolutionary generation we celebrate and which of their deeds we commemorate is inherently placing some actions, some values over others in contemporary life.
Of course, that gets complicated when someone that we believe to be heroic and noble in certain aspects of their life and their decision making also are known to have done things that are really disappointing. And, you know, the fact that many of the founders held slaves is problematic. And Thomas Jefferson in particular has become a figure that we're not quite sure what to do with anymore.
That's for sure. I knew where you were going with that question. that's a perfect example. And on the one hand, we can show that, you know, we can still celebrate a lot of his sentiments and his soaring rhetoric and the words that he wrote in the Declaration of Independence have been used and celebrated in all sorts of different ways all through American history. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't perfect or that we can't still learn from his experiences and as well from the experiences of, say, and of course you're alluding to his relationship with Sally Hemings, who together they had several children, and so that. But just thinking about that, putting her in the picture and her family in the picture, gives us a very different idea of who we are as Americans and who belongs as Americans.
I suppose we're trading something away whether we decide that we need the founders to be paragons of virtue and to ignore everything that they might have done that disturbs us. And we also trade something away when we say, no, we're going to look at these human beings as flesh and blood human beings who could not possibly have been perfect.
You're right. And that's, you know, that's part of being grown up, of trying to keep our ideals and strive to do better ourselves and to better society while understanding that we're human and the institutions within which we're working are human and designed by humans and will never be perfect.
So, Andy, how do essentialists and organicists differ in their understanding of those regrettable facts of our history?
So, in other words, I guess I'm not sure what your so. Do you mean are there debates over dates or numbers or?
No, I guess I mean when we look at something like slavery or the denial of women's rights. If you have a view that the founders had it right, the Constitution is this perfect document, that, you know, we come up against some problems there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, for example, many essentialists have in the last 10 or 15, about 10 years, have started to argue that the three-fifths clause in the Constitution was actually an attempt to put slavery on the road to extinction. Now, what organicists would argue is, and this let me make clear for listeners, the Constitution had a clause. One of the arguments when they were drafting the Constitution was to figure out representation and how many representatives each state would have. And so there was a compromise made that for every five slaves would be counted as three people for the purposes of figuring out how many members of Congress each state would have. And organicists have seen this as a way of entrenching slavery, as a way of ensuring that southern states would be represented enough in Congress to be able to forestall or eliminate any legislative challenges to slavery.
It's worth talking about the fact that the founders, as you've just indicated, were not entirely in agreement on things. Tell us about some of the most important debates among those who agreed that the colonies had a right to independence, but perhaps had different ideas about the shape that self-governance should take.
Well, you can see even among the states that there was a range of different structures. So some of the states had very strong executives. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, had a huge legislature that got elected every year and pretty much no executive at all. There were debates about how strong the national government should be. Should there be a standing army? Should governments be allowed to issue paper money? And if so, who would control that? Who would control fiscal policy? There were some, not many, but some people in favor of the abolition of slavery or of reducing the slave trade, and other people for expanding it. There were many, and of course, when we think about the Constitutional Convention, that was a six-week-long debate about how American government should be structured.
Would the participants in the actual Boston Tea Party instantly recognize kindred spirits in the members of today's Tea Party movement?
That's a great question. One of the things that I think that they might recognize, and I do think that there's a similarity, is a sense of rage, a sense of alienation from government, a sense that that they no longer had control over their government and, to some extent, their lives, a sense that that government and the world was changing in a way that they were being left behind. So in that sense, I think they might see some similarities.
I hadn't realized that the Boston Tea Party itself was sort of forgotten for years. It wasn't like on the tip of everybody's tongue. And then it was revived and celebrated by people looking to make a point in their own times.
Oh, absolutely. It was it wasn't much remembered. It was, and when it was the affair of the tea. And then it wasn't really till the 1820s or the 1830s when it became celebrated in a much different way. And of course, it was then called a Tea Party, which sounds a lot less dangerous than many men going and destroying tens of thousands of pounds. And here I'm thinking pounds as a unit of currency, you know, the unit of British currency, right. Destroying all that private property. That's not something that we usually celebrate in American history.
But then when we described it that way, it became something clearly heroic and something that, you know, its supporters said this is something we ought to be proud of.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the ways to do that is, of course, we're not destroying Americans' private property.
Right.
It's British private property. It's somebody else's. Maybe that's okay.
My guest is Andrew M. Schockett, Director of American Culture Studies and Associate Professor of History at Bowling Green State University. His new book is called Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. We'd love for you to join us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew M. Schockett, Director of American Culture Studies and Associate Professor of History at Bowling Green State University. His new book is called Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Andy, one of the things you did in the process of researching this topic was take a road trip to many of the places that have been set up as historic sites to commemorate the events of the Revolution. First of all, tell us a little bit about that trip.
Sure. I spent about a month first primarily in Philadelphia, but also at Mount Vernon and Colonial Williamsburg and Monticello, and also a little bit of time in Boston and Lexington and Concord, going to sites where we commemorate the American Revolution and seeing how it was interpreted.
And in those places, I guess they all have an emphasis on liberty and on the specific events that happened there. Did you feel the tug of this sort of ideological or political debate that you've described?
Absolutely. You see it in what figures are emphasized and how and who's included. And I think a good contrast is I think there's a noticeable contrast if you visit Mount Vernon, which is George Washington's home, versus Monticello, which was Thomas Jefferson's home.
Tell me about how they're different.
Sure. Mount Vernon much more celebrates George Washington in a fairly unambiguous way. So when you go in, as with many historical sites, there's an introductory film, and the director of Mount Vernon, actually, when they produced the film that they're using now, was very frank. He said, "This film shows George Washington as America's first superhero," and that's the way he's portrayed. But it's also in more subtle ways. If you walk around the grounds and look at the plaques on all the different areas where there are all sorts of different products produced or harvested or so forth, they all emphasize how he, George Washington, directed the plantation. And if you go to Monticello, you see something a little bit different. The introductory film certainly notes Jefferson's achievements, as it should, but it also points out that much more strongly that Monticello was the home of over 100 enslaved people. And as you go around the grounds and see the interpretive materials there, they much more illuminate the lives of the African Americans who worked there and what their lives were like and their contributions than necessarily emphasizing Thomas Jefferson in the areas where slaves lived.
Am I correct in assuming that would not have been the case half a century ago?
It was not even the case, if I remember correctly, it wasn't even the case, say, 20 years ago. About 25 years ago, they have really changed their interpretation a lot at Monticello.
And, of course, there are Americans who say the only way we can really understand this is by looking at the whole thing and all of its facets and in the individuals in history and the events in history. There are other people who say, look, we know that things weren't perfect, but we ought to be focusing on the things we're proud of.
And, you know, there are plenty of reasons for pride, but I think it's also hard for us to look around contemporary society and think that the work of the American Revolution, if that work really was equality and opportunity for all, if that's what the revolution was about, it would be hard to look around American society today and say that that work is unfinished.
Is that what the revolution was about? I mean, to what extent was it really simply about getting out from under the thumb of this foreign government trying to control actions here? And to what extent was it about the ideas that, that there should be a place where people could speak freely and sort of do what they wanted to do without government interference?
This is the wonderful thing about the American Revolution. When we talk about revolutionary era America, we're talking about 2.5 million people. And the American Revolution meant as many different things to them as it does to us.
Were there clues in the revolutionary era as to how this country would eventually deal with the challenges inherent in a much larger population, a much more ethnically and religiously diverse population?
To some extent, and some of the states and cities were fairly diverse even then. So Pennsylvania, New York, and especially New York City. And remember, one of the arguments that we have now is the extent to which the United States was or is Christian. Well, that was a very lively debate in the 18th century, and partly because it was such a polyglot population, because there were so many different Christian sects and Muslims and Jews, and so those questions were contentious even then.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, "Ever better research on some of our best and brightest reveals that failure is inevitable and is needed to learn and grow from. Why is this not fully understood when it comes to our history? And should we not take the good with the bad and progress from there?"
Well, I agree with that, and yet I understand that we also, as human beings and as societies, we also want to have heroes. We also want have this need for people to look up to as paragons, and that happens in every age and every country, every religion, every community has those people that we hold up as being admirable.
Andy, how significant is the fact that we don't actually think of the founding myth as a myth? We think about what we know of the revolution as being grounded in facts, things we were taught in school and believed to be true.
And that's sort of the wonderful, malleable thing about the American Revolution. So on the one hand, we can say, oh, they're real, and we have these documents, and we have these facts. But it's far enough away that we can take these images and shape them and use them for all sorts of different purposes. And, you know, even thinking back to the last question, so for example, when we want in the United States, when we want to have someone who embodies leadership, well, that's easy. We have a George Washington. If we want someone to represent civic mindedness and civic participation, well, that's easy. We have a Benjamin Franklin. And if we want someone who's an eloquent speaker for democracy, that's easy. We have Thomas Jefferson. So in a way, it gives us a shorthand, but the details 200 years later are fuzzy enough that we can shape these images to our purposes.
Give us an overview, if you would, of the kinds of works of art and pieces of entertainment that have illustrated the differences in our views of the revolution and its significance over time?
Well, there are a number of them. Here's an example. A painting from the 19th century, and you may have seen it. It's around the internet increasingly, and it's a painting of George Washington kneeling in the snow praying at Valley Forge. Now, we don't know if this actually ever happened, but the point of the painting and the way it's used is to show George Washington as a devoutly religious Christian man, and to reinforces the image of a Christian country in contemporary politics and culture.
And then you have, of course, there have been numerous movies. You read a lot about the movie The Patriot. For people who haven't seen the film, can you give us a quick overview of what it was about?
Sure. It was about 2 hours and 15 minutes. it was a film that came out in 2002, starring Mel Gibson and Heath Ledger in one of his first major roles. And it was a movie in which Mel Gibson played a South Carolina planter during the American Revolution. And first he's reluctant to join the revolution because he had served in the French and Indian War, and he was afraid of for his family, and he was afraid for the country, not knowing the violence that and rage that would ensue should there be a revolution. And after the British take his family or members of his family and shoot one of his sons, then he joins the fray.
So that movie is a lot, it purports to be a lot about national values. It's a lot about national defense and local defense.
Absolutely. The funny thing is that even the writers and producers of the movie, and Mel Gibson has said this as well, that it was titled The Patriot, and his character was the star, but really the real patriot was Heath Ledger's character, his son, who volunteered to join the Continental Army, whereas Mel Gibson's character really just joined the army to defend his family and to defend his home.
Does the way that we reconsider and repackage the Revolutionary War, not necessarily with any kind of nefarious purpose, but according to the way we understand it, does it ultimately reflect whether we think America is getting better or worse?
Yes, and in a range of ways across the political spectrum. So, for example, there are some conservatives, some essentialists, who would argue that the United States is declining, that from this shining path that we have, that we need to recapture this revolutionary moment of genius, perhaps divinely inspired genius. And some liberals would argue, look, we haven't made much progress here, or we haven't made enough progress.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Manfred on the line in Dallas. Hi, Manfred.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just would like to know what does the guests think about our changing demographics. Pretty soon, in the near future, the minorities will be the majorities. And what does he think will the changing attitudes or views of our history will be?
It's an interesting question. Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, and I think that's part of the anxiety you talked about. Would Tea Partiers, how might Tea Partiers, the original Tea Partiers, think of today's Tea Partiers? And I think part of the anxiety that today's Tea Partiers have is about the issue of race. And if we think of the American Revolution as only being a white elite revolution, that suggests that we have a white country, or maybe that only whites truly belong. But if we think of the revolution as being an event in which people across the spectrum of ethnicity and race participated, in which has a meaning for all Americans, that makes us think very differently about American society and who belongs in it and what it is to be an American and who is an American.
So was the revolution fought for Americans now and into the future, or was it really fought to preserve sort of exactly the conditions that existed then?
There too, it depends on well, there are lots, historians have lots of argue about this all the time, but also if you look back, different people joined fought for or the revolution for different reasons. For some, it had to do with the principles of retaining their what they thought of as their rights as British subjects and British citizens. For others, it was about building a new and different society. And for many African Americans, many enslaved African Americans, it was absolutely about personal freedom, which was why many of them actually joined the British, because they had a better chance of freedom with the British than against the British.
My guest is Andrew M. Schockett. We're talking about his new book, Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll return in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew M. Schockett, who is Director of American Culture Studies and Associate Professor of History at Bowling Green State University. He has a new book out called Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. You can be part of our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Andy, strictly speaking, the Revolutionary War was a fight against foreign control of American affairs. How has it come to serve such a major role in illustrating and embodying frustration with perceived overreach by our own government?
Well, it has a lot of the – there are a lot of similarities in terms of the sorts of issues that many people are angry about today in terms of taxation, but also I think one of the easy things about it as a symbol is that it's a way of finding a bad guy that's not American. So unlike, you know, when we think about the Civil War, and we can say, oh, look, we freed the slaves, it's a little bit complicated because we also held the slaves.
Right, right.
But with the American Revolution, we also have easy external bad guys to pick on. which is another reason why I think right now the revolution, there's this resurgence of the revolution on TV with Turn and Sleepy Hollow and Sons of Liberty. The British provide great villains.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Doyne in Dallas. Hi, Doyne.
Hi, thank you for having me. My question was, why was the Japanese, the Jews, the Indians, and many other indigent needed people to come over here was received reparations, but the so-called Negro was not received any reparations.
Well, have we used, Andy, the revolution and the Revolutionary War to sort of talk about things like this and about whether there should be reparations for peoples who have lost a great deal at the hands of our own government?
There have been some discussions, there have been some in the academic community and among some activists, but to my knowledge, there hasn't been a serious conversation about that, for example, in national discourse or, say, in Congress.
What can you tell us about the ways that historians, American historians, have wrestled with the meaning of the revolution over time?
American historians have been writing about the American Revolution basically since the American Revolution and have found all sorts of different meanings in it. So even as early as the late 18th century and well into the 19th century, it was often portrayed as a very unambiguous, patriotic, national event as a way and also, again, as with the British as being these terrible villains, as a way to justify the revolution and to help establish a national identity. If we look at the early 20th century, Charles Beard wrote a book that was called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, which he suggested that, well, a lot of members of the Constitutional Convention had bonds that were holding securities that if there were a stronger national government, those securities would be honored, and so those men would be enriched by that. And of course, many people were horrified by the idea that these patriots, that some of them might have been thinking about personal gain rather than the glorious founding of the nation. And since it's been used, historians have, during the Cold War, historians primarily argued for a while that it was that Americans all walked almost in lockstep in agreement about the American Revolution, that it was primarily ideological rather than it being also a civil war in which there were a lot of class differences, and more recently, historians much more have looked into issues of slavery and of race. So over time, our contemporary concerns often get reflected in the scholarship.
It's interesting to consider that history in light of the wars that we have most recently engaged in and wonder how our perceptions might change over time. Because we have been doing history for a certain way for a number of years now, it seems like it's really all too easy to assume that we understand what's going on now and we know how to look at these things and we know how to separate out our personal biases. May not be the case.
No, I think you're right, and I think it never is, and that's one of the things that that I and I think a lot of fellow historians we see when you see someone use the term revisionist history or a revisionist historian, often used as in sort of pejorative ways, as if someone is making something up or changing what really happened. Well, every historian is a revisionist historian because we're all thinking about the interpretations that come before and thinking about those in light of new evidence, in light of new theoretical or methodological approaches, or just in light of our own experiences and what we see around us.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sean on the line in Dallas. Hi, Sean.
Yes. I just had a question. Was the American Revolution maybe the cause of it? Did the colonists look at England as, and where their tax money was going to be money that was going from them to maybe rich aristocrats back there, much like I know right now the top 3% own 54% of the wealth, much like maybe even the 99%ers are now looking at, hey, maybe it's time to overthrow, the rich aristocrats here in the United States. And then I guess the second question, if that's the case, is not the name the Tea Party kind of been hijacked, to take away, benefits and stuff from the middle class and the poor as opposed to what the Tea Party originally meant?
What do you think, Andy?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think one, or two really good questions. One interesting parallel is that the original reason for changing the taxes on tea had to do with propping up the East India Company, which was a company thought by Parliament to be too big to fail. The irony there is, though, that actually what happened was the British Imperial Government, Imperial Administration, actually lowered the taxes on tea and increased enforcement against smugglers. And that's what Bostonians and the Tea Partiers were most angry about.
Makes things very complicated, doesn't it?
and that's one of the wonderful things about the event. But there was this general there was among a lot of people a suspicion that the Crown and the Imperial Administration was sort of using this imperial apparatus to help those who were well connected in Parliament, as opposed to thinking about what would best enable not just the British but also British colonists to pursue their own economic well-being. But in terms of sort of thinking about class differences, that's where I think a lot of scholars who look at the American Revolution say we need to think about it not only as a war of or a conflict of independence from an empire, but also look at the conflict among Americans, a lot of which had to do with class and debt and money and who would get to participate in the polity, and so that's where really the significant, I think, class issues of the American Revolution come to the fore that aren't really necessarily taught that much, especially, to our children.
Let's go on the phone now to Stan in Dallas. Hi, Stan.
Hi. I wonder if Andrew would talk about Thomas Paine's little pamphlet, and I was taught that turned the course of the Revolution. And also I would like to add that I've seen online vouchers to officers of the Revolution for the colonies, and some of them made $20,000 to $30,000, whereas the walking around foot soldier, he might have only gotten $100 for his 4 or 5 years in the army.
What can you tell us, Andy?
Well, sure. Well, certainly, when you're talking about Thomas Paine's Common Sense, that was the equivalent of a huge bestseller. And it was one of the things that convinced a lot of people were angry about America's situation, but they weren't necessarily thinking about independence or whether it was possible or on what basis. And that pamphlet, more than anything else, I think convinced a lot of people that what they were doing was the right thing and it was possible. But you're right in terms of service, that officers were basically given different economic assurances as opposed to foot soldiers, and a lot of those were rights basically to Western lands, or they were securities. And we talked about class issues earlier and the Constitution. That was one of the main issues that people were arguing about, because a lot of struggling soldiers sold off these securities for pennies because they needed the money. And then later on, there was a debate, okay, well, should we, when these securities get turned in to the government, who should get the money? Should it, and should it be the speculators who bought them up, or should it be the soldiers who served?
Do essentialists and organicists disagree on whether we have fulfilled the promises of the revolution?
I think so. I think essentialists would argue that we're straying from the ideals of the revolution, and I think that organicists would argue that we've never fully embraced them.
That's interesting. So they agree on the fact that we're not quite there, but for very different reasons.
Absolutely.
And you think we will continue, I suppose, in a healthy way, to debate about the meaning of the revolution for as long as we exist?
I think so. I mean, as long as that is sort of the seminal founding moment of our country, as long as it's the most important symbol we have or set of symbols, it'll be fodder for historians and talk shows and politicians and movies and museums and schools for a long time.
Job security for both of us. Andrew M. Schockett is Director of American Culture Studies and Associate Professor of History and American Culture Studies at Bowling Green State University. His new book is Fighting Over the Founders, How We Remember the American Revolution. Andy, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm at Chris Boyd Think on Twitter. And if you'd like to email the show, you can send that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.